From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A few days ago, George Bush became the first American president to visit Singapore. This newly affluent nation has combined the authoritarian control of communism with the free market economy of capitalism. It might be the wave of the future for some former communist countries. On today's Fresh Air, we find out why from Stan Sesser, who writes about Asia for The New Yorker. Also today, the double life of George Cukor, the director of such classics as Camille, The Philadelphia Story, and A Star is Born. A new biography describes his closeted life as a homosexual in Hollywood. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording featuring excerpts from Swan Lake. He says some passages are breathtaking. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush returned to Washington today after his 12-day trip to Australia and Asia. He expressed optimism that the trip will translate into more American jobs, but he also came back to some bad economic news. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
As Mr. Bush returned, new unemployment figures show that the jobless rate shot up to 7.1% in December. The president expressed his disappointment with those figures, but said his trip will open new markets for American companies and that the resulting job growth will be clear and measurable. However, he acknowledged the trip wasn't a total success.
We might have achieved more. I'm proud of what we did achieve. And I think there's nobody suggesting anyone here is totally satisfied. What I'm saying is we made dramatic progress, and it will result in jobs for the American workers.
A new CBS New York Times poll also shows that 53% of those surveyed think the president's trip was mainly for show. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca said today the United States should retaliate against Japanese automakers if that country does not agree to reduce its $41 billion trade gap with the United States. Iacocca won a standing ovation after his remarks to an audience of more than 2,500 people at the Detroit Economic Club. NATO officials today in Brussels met with representatives from Eastern Europe and members of the Commonwealth of Independent States. One topic discussed was the reduction of conventional weapons in Europe. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
The meeting was called to discuss how the Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Accord, signed in 1990, would be implemented in light of the breakup of the Soviet Union. The collapse of the former superpower had raised concern about whether the Commonwealth states would carry out the provisions of the treaty, which call on the signatories to slash the number of tanks and other non-nuclear weapons in Europe. Today's meeting was set up to establish how the Commonwealth republics would assume the responsibilities of the accord. Kazakhstan was the only republic whose area is covered by the treaty that did not send a representative. The talks were held under the auspices of the North Atlantic Cooperation Council, set up last month by NATO leaders as the place where they could discuss security issues with their former adversaries. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
A Philadelphia youth group today announced a no-gold day to warn city students that wearing expensive jewelry could be deadly. A group called Teenagers Against Negativity organized visits by civic leaders to several schools to tell pupils that self-esteem does not require the display of flashy jewelry. The event was motivated by the October slaying of an 11th grade student who was shot in Philadelphia after she refused to surrender her $450 earrings to attackers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 10 points to close at 3199.46. This is NPR News. Israeli warplanes attacked a Palestinian guerrilla base in the hills of South Beirut today, killing at least 9 people, including civilians. Jim Muir filed this report for the BBC.
The target for the surprise airstrike was a base manned by fighters from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, a radical Syrian-backed faction headed by Ahmed Jibril. 3 guerrillas were reported to have been killed when the building they were manning was demolished. But eyewitnesses and hospital sources said the bulk of the casualties were civilians living in flimsy corrugated iron shacks nearby. An Israeli military spokesman said the guerrilla base was being used for launching attacks against the Israelis and their proxy militia in southern Lebanon. Air raids are often carried out as reprisals for specific incidents. This time, time, though, there was no such obvious provocation, prompting speculation in Beirut that the timing of the attack may have been linked to the resumption of the Arab-Israeli peace talks in Washington, with the aim of undermining the position of moderate Palestinians and strengthening the hand of the radicals.
The BBC's Jim Muir in Beirut. The Supreme Court said today it will decide if U.S. agents can abduct foreign criminal suspects from their homeland and whether Hare Krishnas can be barred from handing out literature or asking for money in airports. The federal kidnapping case involved actions of Drug Enforcement Administration agents investigating the 1985 assassination of DEA agent Enrique Camarena in Mexico. The Hare Krishnas claim the policy violates freedom of speech and religious liberty. The Defense Department said today it will create a new genetic identification system for the military. The armed services will set up a repository of biological samples, which will be placed on identification cards that will be stored in vacuum-sealed packages and then frozen. The system could also be used to identify the dead in mass disasters, such as airplane crashes, where only partial remains of the victims are ever recovered. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush visited Singapore during his just-concluded trip to Asia and the Pacific Rim. Unlike our trade relations with Japan, American business relations with Singapore are now strong. If you don't keep up with this part of the world, you may be surprised to hear that over the past 30 years, Singapore has transformed itself from a country of widespread poverty to great affluence. But it's probably not the kind of economic miracle you'd want to participate in unless you enjoy living under authoritarian control. My guest Stan Sesser writes about Singapore in the current edition of The New Yorker magazine. His research included an interview with Lee Kuan Yew, who has presided over the country since it gained independence in 1959. When Lee stepped down as prime minister in 1990, he took the position of senior minister. This nation has been called Singapore Inc. because its style of government is so much like that of a corporation. But others call the Singapore style neo-authoritarianism, a term I asked Sesser to explain.
This is a new trend that you see happening all over Asia, where the hardline communist countries are looking for a way to survive. Their futures are threatened, and they look at their economies and they say, well, let's free up our economy like Singapore did, and we can continue to repress the people, and as long as they're making money, they won't mind it as much. China has done this, and the word neo-authoritarianism was, in fact, was first used by Chinese think tank scholars. And Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos have all been looking at the Singaporean model. I think it holds considerable appeal to Taiwan and South Korea also, who have had to free up their own governments to some extent. But now they're all suddenly realizing that if you free the economy and people are making a lot of money, they seem to be a lot happier despite a repressive government.
So it's a combination of communist-style authoritarianism with capitalistic free economy?
Exactly. The problem is that this has been successful in Singapore only because the government has totally rejected any notion of corruption. If you take literally one Singaporean dollar as a Christmas gift, you go to jail. Now, when Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, which are riddled with corruption, look at the Singaporean model and say, what a neat idea, we just free up our economy and everyone will be happy and we can continue to be repressive. And then they look at the absence of corruption in Singapore, their ardor for the whole idea might cool. It's absolutely essential that people not resent their government for the office holders getting rich at the expense of the people while they're engaging in this process. And whether this can happen elsewhere on the Singaporean model is the real question.
Well, you say that there's no better example than Singapore of a country that's gone from poverty to riches through good economic management. Let's look a little bit about what's responsible for the economic growth. You say that although Lee, the former head of Singapore, was anti-colonial, he really courted all the multinationals.
He brought the multinationals there, but unlike the rest of the world, he controlled the multinationals. No one controls Lee Kuan Yew. He controls everyone. So, for instance, the multinationals came in, and even when Singapore was impoverished in the early 60s, he insisted from the very first plant that environmental controls were in place. But he freed up everything else and made it so comfortable for them, they didn't mind putting scrubbers in the smokestacks.
And what was in it for Singapore to have the multinationals based there?
Well, Singapore lacked investment capital. That was the big problem. Who was going to put money into a country whose future was so uncertain? The thought in the West was that Singapore would fall to communism by the mid-60s, that it couldn't survive as a small little island state. And it was not a climate that investors would tend to rush in for, and he desperately needed investment capital. And here were the multinationals available with billions and billions of dollars to build all these plants and start producing products and provide employment, and all they needed was the right investment climate, and Lee provided that, and they provided the capital, which Singapore so desperately needed.
Now, you say that Lee was able to drive out low-wage industries like textiles and shoes and bring in the new electronic industries, including computers and computer software. How did he do that?
Well, Singapore started in the 1960s. The only foothold they could get in the industrial world was offering cheap labor to build products textiles and other products. And after a while, Singapore was so successful with this that Lee tried a second strategy, and this was to lure high-tech industries, which would provide much better wages and make Singapore much more prosperous. So he arbitrarily decreed. Now, Singapore is, you talk about a free market capitalist country, but this is a free market capitalist country with a difference. All economic decisions are made by the government. It just so happens that they make wise decisions as opposed to the rest of the world. When governments interfere in economies, they make generally bad decisions. But Singapore arbitrarily ordered wages pushed up, and they told high-tech companies, set up shop here and we'll do everything. And in cases when an entrepreneur wanted to come into Singapore with a high-tech product that was so risky, so much for the future, that the company didn't have enough money, the government of Singapore itself gave the company money to come in and establish a plant. And it was a hugely successful strategy.
What are some of the American companies that have bases in Singapore now?
Oh, all the leading computer companies. IBM, Seagate Technology, all the leading computer companies have manufacturing facilities of one sort or another in Singapore. Mobil Oil is very big. They have a big oil refining facility. General Electric is very big. There are shipbuilding companies, banks. There are probably 700-800 U.S. companies with operations in Singapore now.
And what's in it for them to locate to Singapore or to have, you know, to set up some branches in Singapore?
It's a wonderful deal for them because they get the infrastructure of the United States, even better than the United States. Telephones that work, offices that are wonderfully efficient, terrific secretarial help. Your office can run at a level of efficiency probably seen nowhere else in the world, even in the United States. And by the standards of Southeast Asia, it's just remarkable to see this, what can get accomplished in one day in Singapore. So if you're basing your Southeast Asian operations in Singapore as opposed to Bangkok, where you can't even drive anywhere because the whole city is snarled in an endless traffic jam. If you're basing your operations in Singapore, you can take advantage of this wonderful infrastructure to get all these things accomplished. It's a great thing for them.
And everybody speaks English.
And everyone speaks English, right.
Okay, so Singapore has managed to create this incredibly prosperous economy with new high-tech industry, but there isn't a whole lot of freedom for the people who live there. There's a lot of human rights violations, censorship. Homosexuality is against the law.
Punishable by up to life imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been some people sentenced to life imprisonment for homosexual acts.
You see, now that they're thinking of government incentives to have college graduates marry and breed together so that they're creating a better breed of baby in Singapore.
Well, the government wants to control everything and wants to do everything its way, and to hell with what the rest of the world thinks. Eugenics after Adolf Hitler is not a very popular concept, but this doesn't matter to Singapore, and Lee Kuan Yew is upset. What happens in Singapore is that the men in Singapore, the training is all oriented toward technology, and the young Singaporean Chinese men, the vast majority of the population are Chinese, are a bunch of computer nerds, and they have never laid eyes on a woman and wouldn't know how to take a woman out to dinner or what to do. And the women in Singapore who have now complete freedom to get a university education have university degrees, and the men don't want them. The men want housewives to raise their children. So the women don't get married. Up to half young university graduate women in Singapore are single. And the government's very upset about this. So they provide incentives to marry and breed.
So it just seems like such a paradoxical culture under this neo-authoritarianism, where on the one hand you have this prospering economy. People are making money. Most people own their own homes. On the other hand, they have very little in the way of personal freedom. Does the government think that by having people be economically prosperous, that will prevent any kind of attack on the government or any kind of revolution against it?
The government definitely thinks that, and it certainly will. Singapore is a country where 85% of the people in Singapore own their own apartments, probably the highest rate of home ownership in the world. And the apartment values are going up hugely, so everyone has an economic stake in the system. And to give up that stake to see uncensored movies or read books that the government might not like them to read, well, that doesn't interest people enough. If they want to see an uncensored movie, they go over to Malaysia, buy a videotape of that movie, and smuggle it back into Singapore. But the thing they don't do is demand freedom. You don't demand freedom in Singapore, or you're in trouble.
The United States is, you know, looking at the Pacific Rim, wondering why so many countries have been prosperous there, and what could we learn from their economic prosperity. Are there any lessons for the United States watching an authoritarian government's prosperity? Is there anything we could take away from that?
There actually is a big lesson from Singapore, and that lesson is that government intervention in the economy can be a very important element in getting the economy to take off. In Singapore, government intervention has been all positive. You get companies to take risks. If they're unwilling to supply the capital, the government steps in and supplies the capital itself and joins the company as a partner. You're always encouraging risk-taking. You're always encouraging new exports. In the United States, government intervention seems to be to aid bankers and savings and loan executives and insurance company executives to aid them in the process of looting their companies at the expense of the people. And today we see a trend in the United States that companies are restructuring. IBM lays off 20,000 people. General Electric lays off 10,000 people, whatever. And this is supposed to reinvigorate our economy by laying off people in every industry. Well, in Singapore, this would never happen. People don't get laid off in Singapore. There's full employment. And what happens is you create new products for these people to make. You take risks, and the government encourages risk-taking when it's too much of a financial gamble for the individual company, and that's a lesson we could well learn.
Do you think that there's any way for a country to have the kind of tight economic planning of a place like Singapore without having the authoritarian control over the people who live in the country?
I don't see what tight control over the economy has to do with telling people what books they can and cannot read and what movies they can and cannot watch. The people in Singapore have minds. They're intelligent people. They're well-traveled. They can't be isolated from the rest of the world. I don't see what good it does. I don't see how... I think the government is so paranoid that it feels that any degree of freedom, that people will just seize upon this and tear apart the society. But they're not going to tear apart their own economic interests. So I don't see the relation between the two.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stan Sesser. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he has a piece in the current issue of The New Yorker about Singapore. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Stan Sesser is my guest, and we're discussing Singapore, which is the subject of his current piece in The New Yorker magazine. Well, just a few days ago, President Bush became the first American president to visit Singapore. Why was he the first? Why hadn't other American presidents been there?
Well, the relationship between the United States and Singapore has always been slightly tenuous, although American companies are the leading investors in Singapore. The CIA in 1960 got off to a very bad start when Singapore achieved its independence. The CIA assumed that Lee Kuan Yew was a communist, and they tried to put on the CIA's payroll the head of Singapore's intelligence agency. Lee Kuan Yew found out about it, and then a very high American official came to Singapore and offered Lee Kuan Yew a bribe of $3.3 million if he would keep the affair quiet. Lee Kuan Yew instead rejected the bribe and asked for $33 million in foreign aid for Singapore, and the United States just laughed at that. And that's how relations between newly independent Singapore and the United States started. And Singapore has always resented the idea of the United States lecturing Singapore about human rights and these other so-called Western things, which Singapore feels has no meaning for an Asian society. There's always been resentment against the United States, even though they've been economic allies.
I think the new development that came out of President Bush's visit to Singapore was a tentative agreement to expand military cooperation between the two countries. What do you think is going to come out of that?
Well, this is what Lee Kuan Yew has wanted for years. He wants the United States to protect Singapore, to establish a base in Singapore, and therefore to say to Singapore's Muslim neighbors, you better watch it. You can't pounce upon these Chinese the way you may have wanted to 10 or 20 years ago. Now we've got the United States on our side. This is exactly what Singapore has always wanted, and I think the military relationship between the two countries can only continue to expand. As the United States moves out of the Philippines, they'll be moving more into Singapore, and Singapore will provide them with a base of operations in Southeast Asia. It's so mutually advantageous to the two countries that it has to expand from its current situation.
Now, President Bush has decided not to make an issue of human rights violations for now in Singapore. Would you advise the president to say something about human rights violations in Singapore?
I think the United States has an obligation, particularly in Southeast Asia. When we look at the situation all over Southeast Asia, and so much of the repression of human rights in Southeast Asia is due to the outgrowth of American policies stemming from the Vietnam War and our efforts to contain communism at all costs, we've left behind such a legacy of fascism in Southeast Asia that I think we have an obligation there beyond any place in the world to push a human rights agenda. Not only in Singapore, but in Indonesia, Malaysia, in Thailand with the year-old military dictatorship, all over Southeast Asia. I think it's absolutely fundamental that we push a human rights agenda in that part of the world.
What do you think the chances of that happening are?
Zero. We're fine when it comes to a country like Burma, where we have no economic interests and where there are repeated human rights violations. Then we're free to take a very strong human rights stand. But I think the history of American foreign policy is that human rights has never been the number one preoccupation. It's always been number two to economic interests. And our economic interests are too strong in Singapore, as they are in Thailand also, I think in the eyes of American policymakers, to imperil that at all with any kind of human rights agenda.
What's it like to be a reporter in Singapore? And after all, you interviewed the heads of state. These are the people who have created these tough censorship laws in the country.
Well, it was a very strange experience for me to be in a country that is so prosperous and so westernized on the surface, and yet underneath is so repressive, and to talk to people who are people like anyone you'd encounter in intellectual circles in the United States, and yet find them so fearful about their life, and so unwilling to say anything to me unless it were done in absolute secrecy. In one case, I got an interview only because I beat my answering machine in Berkeley. And I was in my Singapore hotel room dialing my answering machine. There was a message on my answering machine giving me a number in Singapore to call and say, don't identify yourself, don't do anything. When the person answers, just say, I want to make an appointment for lunch. And I followed those instructions, and we ended up at a restaurant, and I met this person who was an establishment journalist, and he thought that Singapore was Nazi Germany. I just could not believe how paranoid he was about Singapore. But to have these sorts of meetings, you'd expect in places where you had the military patrolling the streets and shooting people, and to get this in a prosperous Western country was really a surprise. It was very, very interesting place to be, very interesting if you get beneath the surface of all the Western-style shopping malls and boutiques.
When are you going back to Singapore?
I hope I can get back in. That's a question. Singapore doesn't like foreign journalists who don't toe the line completely, and I think I've departed from the official line on more than one occasion in my New Yorker article. I actually love Singapore. It's a very interesting place, and I'd like to go back soon. And whether I can get in or not is the big question in my mind.
So are you convinced that the leadership in Singapore reads the New Yorker?
Oh, the leadership in Singapore doesn't miss anything. You criticize Singapore and, I don't know, the Idaho Statesman or something, and your name's going to be on the immigration list at the Singapore airport.
So I guess you'll find out when you try to get back in if your name's on the list or not.
Well, I think I'll make a couple discreet queries before I go back in.
Right, right. Well, Stan Susser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Stan Susser is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and in the current edition, he has a piece about Singapore. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. George Cukor directed such classic films as Camille, The Philadelphia Story, Dinner at Eight, Little Women, and A Star is Born. His direction of great but temperamental actresses earned him the reputation for being a women's director. But some people use that as code for homosexual. Cukor's closeted life in Hollywood is described in the new biography, A Double Life. Coming up, we meet the author, Patrick McGilligan. Conductor Arturo Toscanini was a tough act to follow. The man who did follow him as conductor of the New York Philharmonic was Sir John Barbaroli. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has an appreciation of Barbaroli and a review of a new release of some early performances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Labor Department says that the nation's unemployment rate rose to 7.1% last month, to its highest level in nearly 6 years. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Nearly 300,000 Americans joined the ranks of the unemployed in December, according to the Labor Department's monthly report. That brings the number of unemployed to nearly 9 million, the highest level since 1984. In its year-end tally of unemployment figures, the Labor Department reported that the only bright spots were the textile and healthcare industries. And local governments, it reported, also added to their payrolls. Some analysts, however, believe the Labor Department's figures failed to convey the entire unemployment picture. For instance, the monthly unemployment rate does not include part-time workers who would rather work full-time or those simply too discouraged to look for work. This morning's report has already renewed calls among Democrats for President Bush, just back from Tokyo, to do something about the sluggish economy. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
President Bush arrived home this morning from his 12-day trip to the Far East that he contended was not, in his words, a bust. But Democrats on Capitol Hill termed Mr. Bush's trade mission to Japan a failure. The president conceded that more might have been achieved, but he said that he was proud of what was achieved. Several of the nation's leading newspapers have been sharply critical of the president's trip. Chrysler's Lee Iacocca says it's time to change rules which give Japanese companies free access to the U.S. market, while barriers make the Japanese market virtually closed to U.S. carmakers. Don Gagne reports.
In his first public appearance since he accompanied President Bush to Japan, Iacocca told the Economic Club of Detroit that the Japanese promise to buy more U.S. parts and to allow an extra 20,000 U.S. vehicles to be sold in Japan is way too little. Iacocca says now's the time to get tough.
We need to use our own weapons. Good old fashioned American impatience. That means demanding a solution to the problem now and retaliating now if we don't get it. We've already shown all the patience anyone could ask. Hell, 45 years of patience.
Iacocca did say he believes the trip to Japan was a positive, if small, first step. He says it sends the message that the U.S. is serious about dealing with a $40 billion trade deficit with the Japanese. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Russia wants to delay making payments on its foreign debts because it says other Commonwealth states have not paid their share as yet. A top Soviet banking official says this concern will be raised at a meeting next week with members of Western banks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 10 points to close at 3,199.46. On volume of some 236 million shares, trading was heavy. This is NPR News. NATO officials have received a pledge from former Soviet republics that they will honor an arms-cutting treaty. There has been concern about disagreements between Russia and Ukraine involving control of the powerful Black Sea Fleet, and fear this controversy might spread to tanks and other Soviet military equipment. NATO has said that the 1990 agreement must be honored by the former Soviet republics in the wake of the end of the Soviet Union. The agreement calls for deep cuts in tanks and other military equipment. North Carolina Labor Commissioner John Brooks says that he will fight efforts by the Federal Labor Department to take over his state's worker safety program. That program has been criticized since a fire last fall at a chicken processing plant killed 25 people. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports from Raleigh.
U.S. Labor Secretary Lynn Martin threatened this week to take over the North Carolina Worker Safety Program unless Brooks can prove in the next 90 days that the state can do an adequate job protecting worker safety. In his first public appearance since Martin issued her threat, Brooks called it an unfair personal attack upon him and said it may have been politically motivated because Martin is a Republican and Brooks is a Democrat.
There are many agendas, apparently. The U.S. Department of Labor bureaucracy does not like state programs, has never liked state programs, and have attacked all state programs on every opportunity available to them.
Brooks plans to fight the takeover in court if he has to. A spokesman for the Federal Labor Department said Brooks' criticism dilutes attention from the more important issue of worker safety. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Officials in Venezuela have cut oil production by some 50,000 barrels a day. Oil prices have fallen about $6 a barrel on the New York futures market since late October. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Director George Cukor left us with many great films. A Star is Born, The Philadelphia Story, Born Yesterday, Dinner at Eight, Gaslight, and Camille. And who can forget the death scene from Camille?
Nanine, get the doctor quickly.
Doctor, if you can't make me live, how can he?
No, no. Don't say such things, Marguerite. You live. You must live.
Perhaps it's better if I live in your heart, where the world can't see me. If I'm dead, there'll be no stain on our love.
Oh, my guest Patrick McGilligan has written a new biography of George Cukor called A Double Life. Cukor was forced to live a double life because he was a homosexual. Although many of his colleagues knew this, he had to live his life in the closet. Cukor made movies from the 1930s to the early 80s, but even today many gay actors and directors don't think it's safe yet to step out of the closet. In researching this book, McGilligan asked Cukor's friends and colleagues who had always protected his identity to now be as open as possible. Many were understandably reluctant and tried to feel McGilligan out.
They were very interested in to what extent I was going to explore his sexuality, and I think that I compromised with their point of view, or at least I tried to compromise with their point of view, being a more let's say, of the old school, a more tactful, more discreet point of view, and my point of view being one that I would like to know as much as possible. I remember one of the first people that I went to go see that I was introduced to, he asked me very point blank, he said, "You're not going to reveal what goes on behind the bedroom doors, are you?" And I said to him honestly that he would have to tell me what went on behind the bedroom doors before I could tell him whether or not that was important to the book I was writing. I wasn't sure at that point. So I talked to them honestly, and they, I think, spoke to me honestly, and we achieved, I think, a compromise in our positions. And some of them were very courageous to talk to me because they were talking about things that they don't talk about publicly, generally speaking.
Cukor was always called a great women's director, and he was said to have a great gift for directing women. Was women's director code for homosexual?
I think I discovered when I researched his life and career further back that beginning on Broadway and in his summer stock years in Rochester, that he had a reputation as a women's director. So that started before he came to Hollywood, really. And when he came to Hollywood, the publicity machine picked up on it and kind of trumpeted it to newspapers and magazines around the country, and he began to be assigned some movies that starred temperamental or difficult or sensitive actresses. And for a while, he went along with this publicity. It was really orchestrated by MGM once he became a leading director at MGM. But I think in the end, it was a kind of a millstone for him. It became a code word for homosexuality. It became kind of pejorative in some people's mouths. In other people's mouths, it's a great compliment.
I thought one of the most interesting stories in the book was a story about his getting fired from Gone with the Wind. Cukor was the first director of that film. It ended up getting directed by Victor Fleming. You say he was fired from the film because of Clark Gable's objections. What were Gable's objections?
Well, again, it's a long, complicated story, and there were a series of circumstances. And there had been a long pre-production and by the time the film was getting ready to go before the cameras, Cukor was kind of tired of it all. And I think he kind of looked askance at Gone with the Wind from the very beginning. It wasn't his kind of material, didn't have much humor in it. And I think David O. Selznick had become obsessed with it. And there were a lot of problems with budget, and there were a lot of problems with script because Selznick wouldn't make up his mind about the script. And along came the casting of Clark Gable. And Gable and Cukor actually had this curious connection in that one of Cukor's very good friends, William Haynes, who had been a silent screen star and later an interior decorator for many famous people and many people in Hollywood, had had a sexual encounter in the late 1920s, Gable and Haynes. And this was well known in this particular circle. And Gable was made very nervous by Cukor directing him. I don't think Cukor helped matters when he insisted that Gable work on a Southern accent, and Gable eventually put his foot down and would work no further on a Southern accent. And there was all kinds of talk around the office about all kinds of worry that Cukor was going to throw the picture to Vivian Leigh and somehow, you know, forget Clark Gable and not give fair due to his performance. And this was the kind of atmosphere surrounding the set at the point at which one day Gable threw a tantrum and said, "I will not be directed by a fairy. I must be directed by a real man," and he stormed off the set. And it shocked people, and there was just utter silence, and no one knew what to say because whatever else he was, Gable was a complete professional, and he had never done anything like that before. And it really gave David O. Selznick an excuse to shut down the production and have the script worked on, which is what really needed working on, and to fire Cukor as a scapegoat and to bring in Victor Fleming, who was a motorcycle riding buddy of Clark Gable's, and they had a lot of things in common. So it was kind of the final straw in a long series of circumstances. But Cukor, to his private circle and to his close friends, when the doors were closed, he would tell them that this was one of the reasons why he was fired, and it hurt him deeply that he was betrayed by David O. Selznick at this point. Other times later in his life, he would be often asked why he was fired. It's really one of the great mysteries, or it was considered one of the great mysteries in Hollywood lore, and he would say, "I've blanked it out. I can't really remember. It's not too important." Or he would come up with some kind of superficial excuse that no one ever felt comfortable with, and it was because he couldn't tell the real reason.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the director, George Cukor. My guest is Patrick McGilligan, author of a biography of Cukor called A Double Life. And Cukor directed many films, including Camille, Adam's Rib, Little Women, A Star is Born, The Philadelphia Story. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick McGilligan, and we're talking about George Cukor, the subject of McGilligan's new biography. I think a very interesting story that you tell is how George Cukor went to see the Charles Ludlam version of Camille. Now Cukor had directed Greta Garbo in Camille, and Charles Ludlam was a director who passed away a few years ago from AIDS, and he ran something called the Ridiculous Theater Company, in which he would star in drag in classic women's roles, and he played the role of Camille on this production that Cukor went to see. It was a wonderful production. What was Cukor's reaction to it?
Well, Cukor made a brave effort to adapt to the 60s and to the 70s. He lived much longer than a lot of his contemporaries, and he lived to see gay liberation. And he was terribly I would say he was afraid of gay liberation for a while, and then he was a little bit intimidated by it, and then he was a little intrigued by it. He was certainly very confused by what he saw at that production of Camille. It did not make a lot of sense to him. You were asking someone to move from one era into the next all too rapidly. And yet I think, you know, it says a lot for him that he was willing to go see it and think about it and react to it.
How did Cukor feel about being gay? Were you able to get a sense of that?
Well, I think he accepted it at a very early age, meaning as a teenager. I think he discovered his sexuality the same way anybody else did, you know, thinking about it and wondering about it and then finally trying it and deciding. But I think he felt somewhat ashamed of being homosexual. I'm not sure, that might be too strong of a word, but he was raised in a Victorian era where it was against the law in many ways to be a homosexual, and that police were always coming after homosexuals for various either implied or actual behavior that even by any standards would be considered innocent today. And I think this, and then plus the fact that he had to play this game in Hollywood so that he would have to be terribly circumspect on the set and when at work and at home was where he indulged his private life. This, I think, made him wary and to some extent ashamed, and it certainly created a psychology that was complex.
There's some odds and ends stories about some of the films that Cukor directed that I'd like for you to tell. One of his classic films is Camille, which starred Greta Garbo. It's a wonderful film. But you tell the story of how Cukor used to mimic the actors and actresses while he was behind the camera directing.
Yes. He had a lot of different ways of directing, but one of his ways of directing was to stand behind the camera and mouth the lines and almost kind of violently mouth them so that he was almost a distraction to them. And it certainly was a distraction to Greta Garbo, who would probably have preferred to act her scenes always with nobody around except the camera. And he was, at one point, she was doing one of her very sad scenes. Of course, it's a very sad movie. And he was, you know, virtually weeping crocodile tears as he watched her, and his mouth, you know, distorted, and she banned him from the set so that she could finish off the scene. Not atypical of Garbo, and not atypical of Cukor in the sense that he was a very flamboyant character on the set and very much in charge, and that's one of the ways he did direct, was to show people how to do things, not actually to act it, but to mimic it.
Did you find out anything about how he got the mood in Camille?
Well, I write in the book that Camille happened to coincide with the death of his mother. And, of course, the climax of Camille is the death of Camille, or at least the ending of the picture. And his mother had died shortly before he was to film that scene. And so he was really shuttling between reality and motion pictures at that point, because he had, being an utter professional, he came back to work to film that scene. He liked to say that he didn't really tell Greta Garbo what to do in that scene, but he remembered how his mother had turned her head to the wall because she was suffering so greatly that she didn't want her son to see her suffer in her final hours, and that somehow he communicated this to Garbo, and she did something similar in the scene. I'm not sure it's there in the scene. I'm not sure it's there in the cut that we see in videos and on television and at revivals today. But it certainly meant that he was feeling that movie very deeply, and he was feeling that character very deeply, and that it coincided with his life at a time when, which is one of the reasons why it's one of his greatest films, and you can watch it today, and it stands up, and it's a beautiful film.
Now, Cukor didn't direct The Wizard of Oz, but he was a consultant on it. What does he take credit for in the film?
Well, I don't think he was much of a consultant. At MGM, you know, they would say, run over to Lot 6 and check in for a couple of days and help so-and-so who's needs help on this. Wizard of Oz had numerous directors, and at one point they called Cukor in and asked him to take a look at Judy Garland and give some advice, and she had on a blonde wig, and he threw a fit, you know, and said, take off that blonde wig. She looks like a horror. And she was adopting some kind of funny accent, and he told her to stop acting fancy schmancy and just speak like someone from Kansas. And this is just about all he did. It probably took 2 or 3 days of looking at things and then talking to her. And it's not, you hear this kind of story about Cukor over and over again, that he would give this kind of advice and that he would do a little thing that would really unlock an actress or an actor and really help them with their performance. And imagine that movie with Judy Garland in a blonde wig.
With an accent.
With any kind of accent. She was striving. She was striving to do something that she needn't stride so hard to do, and that's what he was telling her.
Now, he later directed Judy Garland in A Star Is Born, which I think might be her best film, but this was a period in her life where she was having tremendous problems, terrible mood swings, drug problems, food problems, a lot of weight fluctuations during the making of the film. How did he handle that? What was his approach?
Well, he always handled it the same way. And he had run across this problem dating back to Broadway, meaning actresses who drank too much and didn't show up on time a temperamental, sensitive, fragile, neurotic. In Judy Garland's case, he had grown to know her and he had grown to like her a lot and really feel admiration for her talent. And when he was offered a chance to direct A Star Is Born, he leaped at it. And she was very difficult. She was suffering in many ways during the making of that film. And his reaction was always the same. When he had that problem with Garbo, when he had that problem with Marilyn Monroe later on, his reaction was patience. And his reaction was nurturing. And his reaction was kindness. And if he lost his temper at a moment, it was usually strategic. But he was always the kindest of men in that regard, and he helped her through the film, and he helped her to her most compelling performance and her greatest film, certainly.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of George Cukor, A Double Life. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, I understand there's something you've been working on for a while that's going to be on today.
Hi, Terry. We have quite an extended conversation tonight with Robert Persig. He's been quite reclusive. This is the only broadcast interview he's done for his new book, which is called Lila, An Inquiry into Values. This book is about a sailboat rather than motorcycles. Persig wrote, of course, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance in 1974. He published that book after 100 companies turned it down, and it continues to sell many thousands of copies every year. Persig says in this interview that Lila is his final book. He hopes professional philosophers will examine the work and begin to take him seriously.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sir John Barbaroli was the beloved British conductor of the Halle Orchestra. He made numerous recordings before his death in 1970. Some of his earliest have just been reissued on a new CD called The Young Barbaroli. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
One of the things Sir John Barbaroli is best known for in this country is that he took over the New York Philharmonic in 1936 when Arturo Toscanini resigned. Toscanini and Barbaroli had several things in common. They both played the cello, and they both had fathers who were born in Italy, who were in fact friends. But otherwise, there couldn't be two more opposite musical personalities. If Toscanini was all energy and slashing brilliance, Barbaroli was softer-edged and milder-mannered. In the age of stereo, Barbaroli conducted one of the greatest Mahler recordings ever made, the Tragic Symphony No. 6. On this new disc, it's nice to hear what he sounded like in the 1920s and 30s on some of his earliest recordings with his own chamber orchestra. There are excellent versions of Haydn's Last Symphony, Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a little Henry Purcell hornpipe, and a particularly evocative performance of Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite. Barbaroli conducts with a traditional grace and elegance. He builds the music with considerable power and lets it flow. The rather old-fashioned style of the Purcell, Haydn, and Mozart, though, in 60-year-old sound, may be a turnoff to anyone who is not already deeply interested in Barbaroli's career. But there's at least one selection on this new disc that is indispensable. It's a set of five brief but breathtaking excerpts from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Listen to the lilting waltz. It's so buoyant, you want to get up and start waltzing, too. Famous pas de deux from the second act of Swan Lake is even more impressive. Barbaroli is conducting not his own orchestra here, but Sir Thomas Beecham's great London Philharmonic. Beecham's oboist was Leon Goossens. The freedom of Goossens' phrasing in the oboe lament is one of the most amazing passages ever recorded. Goossens is less like an instrumentalist here than a great singer. You can hear the yearning for love, the longing for freedom in every note. I've never heard anyone else come even close.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed The Young Barbaroli. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock, Sue Spolin, and Sue Weinstein. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Science writer Timothy Ferris usually explains how the distant stars and galaxies were formed. On the next Fresh Air, Ferris turns his attention inward to how our minds work. Also, we talk with actor Harvey Keitel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you join us for the next Fresh Air.